Well, last Sunday, I was shocked and very disappointed. We went to Williamsburg, Colonial Williamsburg, to be exact, and I had an article in mind. Now, as it happens, I've actually written three articles already as a result of my visit to Jamestown and Williamsburg last weekend. One of them is the web commentary. It's on the web right now, and I've had a few comments on that one already. There's going to be one on World News and Prophecy as well, and then also one on the Good News. And each one covers different aspects of this. As you know, Jamestown was the first English settlement in North America and was extremely important in the formation of the United States. If Jamestown had not been successfully settled, the United States would not exist. That was pointed out to us quite clearly. The United States goes back, its origins do go back to those people who landed in Jamestown. And what they went through was absolutely unbelievably horrendous, far worse than, what most people have to go through in their lives. But they held on, and out of them and others eventually came the United States of America. But it was the 400th anniversary at the end of April, beginning of May. And Williamsburg became the second capital. Jamestown was the first capital of the colony of Virginia. And then in 1699, the capital was moved to Williamsburg. And the old colonial capital at Williamsburg has been very well preserved. And it's well worth a visit if you've never been there. They try to preserve it exactly the way it was in the 18th century. You can actually go around the governor's mansion. You can go around the House of Burgesses, which was their parliament or their congress. During colonial times. You can walk the streets, and in each of the old houses that are preserved from the 18th century, they'll have people showing you different things. And it's very interesting. I mean, one thing you notice, for example, is that none of the houses have bathrooms, so that does raise questions as to exactly what they did over 200 years ago, but I don't think this is the time to go into the details. But also along the street where you've got all the different stores, you see people who are demonstrating the crafts that were common at that time. So, a carpenter is there explaining how he makes all the different furniture, and you've got others there as well in these different stores along the street. Then you've got some of the taverns where the revolution was plotted, and these taverns are very well preserved and, well worth a visit. Very expensive, though, the meals that are served in them. But, it really is a nice experience, and we really enjoyed it. One of the places that is there is Bruton Parish Church, and I wanted to go in Bruton Parish Church, and I'll tell you why in a few minutes. But when I went in, I was really shocked. I've been in it twice before. In fact, I was there just over 4 years ago, and then I saw something which I wanted to get a better picture of to illustrate an article. And what it was a copy of a Bible that was presented on the 300th anniversary of the settlement at Jamestown. It was presented by King Edward VII to President Theodore Roosevelt. And the message on this dedication from the king emphasized how the Bible had laid the foundation for Anglo-American civilization, for both England and America, and had been the most important book in the history of both nations. This is only 100 years ago that this Bible was given. So I went into the church. I knew exactly where it was, so I just walked right there. But it wasn't there. The Bible was missing. And so I walked all over the church. It's only a small church. It's a lot smaller than this room. So I walked all over the church looking for this Bible. Now, I thought it was very symbolic that here I was in an Episcopalian church, a Protestant church, looking for the missing Bible. Go try and find a Bible in a Protestant church. I think this says a great deal about the state of religion in the United States today, about Protestantism. I could not find that Bible. So eventually, I went up to one of the older lady volunteers there and asked her, where has the Bible gone? I think she came up to me and asked me, are you looking for something? And I said, yes, I'm looking for something that was just over there. And she asked me what it was, and I said, it was the Bible. And she said, it's been moved, she said. And I wasn't very happy about it, she said. But it's been moved. And I said, well, where's it been moved to? She said, well, it's been put in the bell tower. The bell tower? I mean, what good is it having a Bible in the bell tower? That would be the equivalent of me taking my Bible now, leaving it in that side room while I give you a sermon. You know, what would be the point? But it was in the bell tower. Now, as it happens, you do have to go through the bell tower to get into the church proper, to get into the sanctuary. But the Bible had been removed and was in a small case in the bell tower where nobody would really see it unless they were really looking for it. So, you know, I went off looking for it and did find it in the bell tower. And my wife very carefully took a picture of this Bible and the dedication from the king to the President of the United States. Now, the lectern upon which the Bible rested until recently was still standing in the sanctuary. There were other things on it now, no Bible. I think a hymnal was on it, but there's certainly no Bible was on it. The lectern was presented by President Roosevelt to this church. So that was still there. But, you know, I want to write an article about this for the Good News. In fact, I have started the article for the Good News. I haven't finished it yet. But the article is about this, just the missing Bible. And it really, I think, sums up the attitude towards the Bible today. You know, I think 3 or 4 years ago, I've forgotten exactly when it was, but my wife and I went to Ghana for the feast, and we happened to stop in London in England to see a couple of old friends there that we were at college with. And these old friends, much to our disappointment, had left the Church of God and were now members of the Church of England, which is the Episcopalian Church, the same as the Church of Bruton Parish in Williamsburg. They joined the Episcopalian Church, and that particular morning, Linda, the wife, was going to be singing at church. She was in the choir and asked us if we'd go along. And I thought, you know, this might be interesting. And I hadn't been to a Protestant church in well over 3 decades. So anyway, so we went along to hear her sing. And it was, you know, it was their harvest festival where they're giving thanks for all the food and, you know, which they're eating, and, you know, they take food up to the front in order to help the poor. But anyway, what I found interesting in this was, in this one-hour service, there was a five-minute sermon, and not once was God mentioned, not once. Not once in the whole one-hour service was there anybody reading from the Bible, okay? Now, that five-minute sermon, by the way, was all about giving thanks to Mother Nature for the harvest. So thanks to nature, not to God. It's almost like they gag on the word God. That was the impression I got as I was leaving. The only thing that was religious in the whole ceremony, in the whole service, was the music. Some of the songs that were being sung, because they were singing things from the 18th and 19th centuries. So, you know, when people did believe in God. But it was interesting to me because it had been, 35 years or more since I'd been in the Methodist Church. And it was interesting to me just to see how God and the Bible had been cut out of some of these church services. I'm not saying they're all like that, because they're probably not. I'm not surprised it was like that, because I have read surveys in the past of Church of England clergy, Episcopalian clergy in England over the years, and routinely, roughly a third or 50% say they don't believe in God, which raises the question, why on earth are you in the clergy in the first place? You know, it does make you wonder, why would you join the ministry of a church if you don't believe that there's a God? It doesn't make any sense. But, you know, if you were looking for sense, that wasn't the right place to be. Anyway, to get back to last Sunday, as I said, the Bible was missing. And I did finally find it in that glass case that was hardly noticeable, adjacent to the door that would take visitors from the hallway to the sanctuary. The dedicatory message from the king read thus, I'll read it to you. This Bible is presented by His Majesty King Edward VII, King of Great Britain and Ireland, and Emperor of India, to the Church of Bruton, Virginia, a shrine rich in venerable tradition of worship, in solemn memories of patriots and statesmen, and in historic witness to the oneness of our peoples. The king will ever hope and pray that the ties of kingship and of language and the common heritage of ordered worship and of ennobling ideals may, through the saving faith in our Lord and Redeemer, Jesus Christ, revealed in these sacred pages, continue to unite Great Britain and America in a beneficent fellowship for setting forward peace and goodwill among men. So, you know, clearly showing the influence of the Bible on both countries. And it was acceptable to say this in 1907 and to write this as a dedication the king presented this Bible to the peoples at Bruton Parish Church. And, you know, the lectern that President Roosevelt gave to the church is of an eagle carrying, you know, symbolic of the United States, carrying, got the lectern on its back. And that's where the Bible goes. So it's like, you know, the eagle carries the Bible. So there's a symbolism there as well. You know, great symbolism lost completely today because no explanation there anymore as to why it's there, what it's doing there, and what the significance is historically. Now, prior to visiting Williamsburg, we had toured Jamestown, which was the site of the first permanent English settlement in the New World. While there, we visited a replica of the original settlement, which included a church building. And we were in a small group, about 20 people. In the church, our guide asked us if any of us had heard of the King James translation of the Bible. Now, you know, I was taken aback by this because, you know, frankly, growing up in England, I can say that in England, you know, religion really has pretty much died out. It is certainly the post-Christian age. But in the United States, you know, that has been somewhat different. But I think America is rapidly following England, and perhaps at most is only one generation behind. But, you know, this question was asked, have any of you heard of the King James translation of the Bible? Now, understand, to previous generations, this was the most significant book ever published. Historians will tell you, but history books point out, this is the most significant book in history, the King James translation. The Greek and Hebrew scriptures only went to so many people. But it was when the King James translation was published in 1611 that the Bible went out to all the world. And it influenced our language in so many ways. There are so many words that we use, so many expressions that we use that come from the Bible. And, you know, that Bible has been read by more people than any other book ever published in the history of mankind. So a very influential book. And here's this man asking us, as we go on this tour through Jamestown, have any of you ever heard of the King James translation of the Bible? And as soon as he asked that question, something very notable happened. And to me, very revealing of the way so many people feel today. As soon as he asked that question, most people in our tour group started walking away to look at other things. The musketry display was particularly well attended after this. You see, as soon as you bring up the subject of religion, most people are not interested. Okay? You know, I think this is part of the challenge that we have certainly got today in preaching the gospel, because first of all, we have to establish the relevance of the Bible. And, you know, this is to a generation that really does not understand the relevance of the Bible. But as soon as this question was raised, people in our group started wandering off looking at other things. The significance of the King James translation of the Bible in the history of early America seemed of no interest to most of those touring Jamestown that day. And yet, if it wasn't for the English Bible, Jamestown would never have been settled. And America would not exist today. That is how significant the Bible was. I want to read to you a quote from a book here. You can find it here. Well, no, let me leave that little quote a bit here. But I was reading a book while I was on the plane going out to Richmond and coming back also, called Sea Venture by Kieran Doherty. And this is about one of the ships that brought people over to Jamestown. Now, the first ship came in 1607 with 104 settlers. Within 6 months, there were only 38 left. So 66 died in the first few months in Jamestown, mostly of disease, also of starvation. And they also died, some of them, because of hostile acts committed by Native Americans at that particular time. But, you know, they were down to 38 when the next ship came. And as soon as word got back to England that they needed more people, 9 ships were sent out, and one of these ships was called the Sea Venture. And it's just unbelievable the conditions that people lived under on these ships. Now, I say now before you all, I will never complain again about flying across the Atlantic on any airline, because no matter how bad it is nothing compared to what these people went through. You know, the first ship that came took 144 days to get here. There was no washing water on board in all that time. Nobody could wash in the whole 144 days. It wasn't because they'd lost the water. There just was no washing water on board. There's nowhere to put it. So they had no way for people to bring water or to carry any containers that would enable people to bathe on this journey. So for 144 days, they could not wash. They could only eat the coarsest food that could survive a long time. You know, basically it was biscuits and flat beer is basically what they lived on, because the water would get stagnant and could be, you know, could cause all kinds of sicknesses. So, you know, it was terrible. But this is what it says here in this book, Sea Venture. As peaceful and beautiful as the natural surroundings were, life on board the Sea Venture was anything but pleasant. Despite the steady wind, there was hardly a passenger on board who did not suffer from seasickness. Even seasoned mariners were known to seek the comfort of the ship's rails during the early stages of a voyage. Landlubbers might be sick for weeks. Within days of leaving port, the ship stank of vomit and garbage and food scraps and other foul leavings that were discharged or that seeped into the ballast area. These ships were very small, by the way. Diane and I walked around one. I couldn't believe how small they were. The stench was made even worse by the mingled odors of unwashed bodies crowded together like animals. They even had animals on board the ship because they had to have meat. So they took live animals that, of course, relieved themselves all over the place, and then they would kill them at various times along the journey. With so much space below decks taken up by stores, there was scant room left on the roughly 100-foot ship for mariners and passengers to live and sleep. Basically, the middle level of the ship was where all the passengers slept. 104 of them. I mean, I can tell you, the whole area, we've had bedrooms that were bigger than that area throughout our lives. And yet they had 104 people cramped into that space. It says here, all 100 or so passengers lived amidships, sleeping on pallets separated by canvas or wood partitions without enough headroom to stand upright, with little sunlight or air. Whenever possible, for obvious reasons, they took to the deck for a breath of fresh air and a chance to walk or stretch without treading on some neighbor's feet. At night, in fine weather, they slept under the stars or perhaps under the ship's boat, turned turtle on the deck. The most personal acts were performed in public. I mean, you had no choice. Passengers in need of toilet facilities were forced to use slop buckets that soon spilled over and added to the general smell below, or to climb into the beak all the way forward on the boat, where they would perch precariously on a seat to relieve themselves as the vessel rolled with the waves, and then they cleaned themselves using a length of rope that hung down the side of the boat so that it trailed in the ocean below. So everybody would use the same piece of rope to clean themselves up after relieving themselves. And then the rope would go into the water, and the hope, I guess, was that the salt water would kill whatever germs were on there. I mean, this is just awful, isn't it, listening to this? But by the way, these conditions were pretty good compared to what they had to go through when they reached Jamestown. Even in these cramped, almost intolerable conditions, people somehow managed to, you know, make it through until they got to Jamestown. It says, of course, there were moments of reprieve on the voyage across the Atlantic. The passengers and crew gathered each morning and evening and each Sunday for prayers. You know, they had church services on board the deck, as you see later on in the book. And, you know, they prayed twice a day. I guess living in those conditions, they really needed to pray twice a day. And they had church services every Sunday. It was interesting, in Jamestown, we were told that the original settlement, which was not a religious settlement, by the way, wasn't like New England, wasn't like Plymouth Colony, which was founded by the Pilgrims. Virginia was settled by people who went there to make money. They weren't a very religious people, particularly, but they were religious. They weren't the super zealots that the Pilgrims were. But in Jamestown settlement, if you missed church, well, you know, you were not able to eat that day. They only had one meal a day because that's all the food they had. And at some points, they didn't even have that. If you missed church, then you had nothing to eat all day. Missed church a second time, and you were put in the stocks, and people could throw whatever they wanted to at you. Missed church the third time, and you were put to death. That was the punishment. And I was surprised at that. I thought they were kicked out of the settlement. And maybe if you missed church the third time, while everybody else was in church, you probably would have run away. So I guess it amounts to the same thing, because you would have known what was coming. So, you know, you'd go and face the Native Americans rather than stick around and be definitely executed. But that was the punishment. This is a people that were not particularly religious compared to the Pilgrims. But, you know, this is the way that it was. Now, why did they settle in Jamestown? It's an island with water on three sides, hot, humid, and swampy. They needed a secure location to protect themselves from Spain, from the Spanish. The Pope had given North America to the Catholic Church, and most of South America too. Part of South America that we now call Brazil was given to Brazil. I should have said it was given to Spain. And Brazil, and I said the Catholic Church, but, you know, most of South America was given to Spain, part of it to Portugal, but North America was given exclusively to the Spanish, and they had nominal control of the whole of North America. So when the English settlement landed, they had to make sure they had somewhere that was secure and hidden from the Spanish. The fear of Catholicism was very great, because it was only, roughly 80 or 90 years earlier that they had broken away from Rome. And Rome was still saying that if anybody forced these Protestants, these heretics, back into the Catholic Church, they were doing God a favor. And, of course, the Catholic Church was the majority. So, you know, Protestants lived in absolute fear of Roman Catholicism. And this went on for a long time, by the way. For a couple of hundred years, because even in the French and Indian War in the middle of the 18th century, 150 years later, that was a major factor. People were afraid of the French because the French were Catholics, and the people in the English colonies did not want to come under France and be forced to become Catholics. And all of this goes back to the fact that when they freed themselves from Rome, they were able to read the Bible. A very significant book in the formation of America. So it strikes me as so sad that today it is so little appreciated and even banned in our public schools and many institutions of higher learning. And, sad to say, even many people in the Church of God don't spend much time reading it, don't appreciate it as much as we should. You know, there are over 3,000 translations available today. At the time that Jamestown was founded in 1607, there were a number of translations. None of them had been authorized. Different people had translated the Bible, and you had a lot of disputes as to exactly what was meant. This is why when King James came to the throne in 1603, he ordered an authorized translation of the Bible, which is what we call the King James Translation. In fact, in England, it's called the Authorized Version, the AV. Here is the KJV, King James Version. And it was authorized by the king. And the king called 50 of the greatest scholars in England, those that were most learned in Greek and Hebrew, to translate the Bible, and also in Latin, because they looked at the Latin manuscripts as well. That lasted 7 years. It took 7 years to translate it, by the way, which I think is rather significant. 7 years, seven, the number of completion. And after 7 years, in 1611, it was published and became the most significant book in the history of the world. And it was taken by people throughout the world. Quoting from... a book I've got here called God's Secretaries, about the 50 men that translated the Bible. The book says this: the sponsor and guide of the whole Bible project was the king himself, who was one of the best educated monarchs in history. He spoke fluent Greek, Hebrew, and Latin, and also was the greatest expert in the world on French medieval poetry, which sounds awfully boring. Actually, Greek, Hebrew, and Latin sound awfully boring too. But I guess it's good that some people can read these languages. Anyway, about 50 scholars from Cambridge, Oxford, and London did the work, drawing on many previous versions, and created a text which, for all its failings, has never been equaled. There had been other translations earlier, but no authorized version, so there was a great deal of confusion. And, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence that that first settlement in 1607 in Jamestown and the publication of the King James translation of the Bible pretty much coincided. The King James translation was already coming together in 1607, and by 1611 it was published. And, you know, I cannot emphasize enough just how important that has been in our history. In fact, I titled this sermon, Jamestown and the KJV, the King James translation of the Bible. And I think when we look at prophecy relating to the United States, the most important chapter in the Bible, if you don't like reading the Bible, you find it difficult to study, read this one chapter and keep it in mind, because it really sums up everything, and that is Deuteronomy chapter 28. Deuteronomy chapter 28. Because Deuteronomy chapter 28 is a prophecy to the people of Israel. And if you remember, in Genesis chapter 48, the ancestors of the United States and of Great Britain, Joseph, you know, when Jacob is blessing them, when Israel is blessing them, he says, let my name be named on them. Israel's name was to be named on them. And it says here in verse 1 of chapter 28, now it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth. You know, in 1607, when Jamestown was founded, the greatest nation in the world, the superpower of the day, was Spain, Catholic Spain. That was the greatest nation in the world at that particular time. Why didn't it stay Spain? You know, why did it change? Well, the English people had a vision, and their vision was driven by their dedication to the scriptures at that particular time. Let me quote from a book called Wide as the Waters by Benson Bobrick. I've quoted to you from this before, but let's have a look at this particular passage again. Benson Bobrick is a graduate of Columbia University who lives in Vermont. Only in England was the Bible in any sense a national possession. Englishmen carried their Bible with them as the rock and foundation of their lives overseas. Remember, all those people who founded the colonies were English. Okay, so, you know, they are ancestors to many of you here. Englishmen carried their Bible with them as the rock and foundation of their lives overseas. Beyond the shores of Albion, which is the old Roman name for England, it fortified the spirit of the pioneers of New England, helped to shape the American psyche, and through its impact on thought and culture, eventually spread the world over, as wide as the waters be. The title is taken from a poem about John Wycliffe, who is the father of the English Bible and of the Reformation. John Wycliffe lived from 1330 to 1384, and he was the first person to translate the Bible into English. But it was his own translation. You know, one man translating the Bible, you can't rely absolutely on accuracy. The good thing about the King James translation was you had 50-plus people working on it, all checking each other. This is what makes the King James translation and its successor, the New King James translation, the best translation. Not perfect by any means, but the best, because a number of people were involved. Just to compare, for example, draw an analogy here with our literature in United compared to literature that comes from a lot of others in the churches of God. In many of the churches of God, people just write what they want. Everything written by United must be approved by at least three other pastors before it can be published. And in some cases, there are a dozen people involved in the review process for every article. This means that although we're not perfect, mistakes are rare. And it also means that at least when it comes to doctrine and when it comes to interpreting the scriptures, there is certain consistency and certain accuracy. You can't come out with something wild, but you can in some of these other groups, you see. So, you know, it's a warning about some of the literature published by some people as well. But it's the same thing with the King James translation. It was put together, you can put it this way, put together by a committee. They were all reviewing each other. The kings sat in their meetings every week for 7 years. And they agreed on the interpretation of the different scriptures as they went through the Bible. So, you know, very dedicated group of men. But the reason why the book is called Wide as the Waters is because Wycliffe, the father of the English Bible, was condemned by the Roman Catholic Church as a heretic because he translated the Bible. The teaching of the church was that the Bible was only for the priests. And the fact is most priests couldn't read, so therefore the church's teachings, you know, were based mostly on ignorance and superstition. Not much has changed, I might add. But, you know, that's the way that it was. The church was all powerful. I was rather shocked recently. There was a letter in the Lansing State Journal from somebody, obviously a Catholic, who was claiming that, you know, Protestants, he said, are all crazy because they're inconsistent because they say that the Bible was inspired by God, but it was written by man. So then his point was, well, if they believe that, why can't they believe that the Pope is inspired by God and everything coming from him is ex cathedra, comes from God? And then he went further in a second letter and said, you know, the Catholic Church is the oldest church, and the Catholic Church preserved the Bible for hundreds of years before the Protestants came into existence, which is absolutely untrue. You know, during the Inquisition, the first question that people got asked was, have you ever read the Bible in your own language? And if they had, they were put to death. They were burned at the stake. So the Catholic Church actually tried to stamp out the Bible, not preserve the Bible. But people can write whatever they want, and of course it gets published in the newspaper, especially the Lansing State Journal. Wycliffe was condemned as a heretic, and his bones were exhumed and removed from the grounds of Lincoln Cathedral. And when his remains were disinterred and burned, this poem was written by somebody, and it's a prophecy, really. And the prophecy was that out of England would come this Bible that would be spread round the world. The Avon to the Severn runs, the Severn to the sea, and Wycliffe's dust shall spread abroad, wide as the waters be. And the zeal of his followers was to take the Bible into all the world. And the Wycliffe Foreign Bible Society still exists. You know, and they still translate the Bible into every language on the planet. And they try to spread the Bible as much as possible around the world. It doesn't bother them how it's interpreted. The point is, people must have the Bible. They must be able to have a Bible. And, of course, in some countries, it's still banned. The Bible is still a difficult book to obtain in some parts of the world. Look at Philippians chapter 2. Philippians chapter 2. This is John Wycliffe's favorite verse. And it helps you understand Jamestown and Virginia. Virginia being the first English colony that was established. In Philippians 2 and verse 12. Therefore, my beloved, as you've always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. You know, this is Wycliffe's, this is where his emphasis was. The church taught, the Catholic Church taught that you cannot go to God except through the priest. Wycliffe taught that everybody must have their own personal relationship with God. Certainly, he wasn't saying that priests or ministers are not, you know, not necessary, not required. There's still a role for them. But, you know, everybody has a personal relationship with God, which is absolutely correct. And this was the a main driving force behind the Protestant Reformation, that everybody has a personal relationship with God. And of course it was taken further too, that everybody has responsibilities when it comes to government as well. And it's no coincidence. Jamestown was founded in 1607, and in 1619, Jamestown became the first English colony to have a parliament, the House of Burgesses. And you had representatives. People voted. You know, over 90% of the men voted, which is better than now. We sometimes think America, the United States, was the first democracy, but these colonies were democracies 150 years earlier. And, you know, people were voting, and they sent their representatives to the House of Burgesses, starting in 1619. And that was the first parliament outside of England. England had one from 1265, but Virginia was the first place overseas. And, you know, eventually that got moved to Williamsburg. And I got an account here of the first parliament meeting when the General Assembly met in July and August 1619 in the little church beside the river. You see the connection between between parliament and church. You know, the church was the place where everybody came to worship God, also the place where they would make decisions on the governance of this colony that was dedicated to God and the Bible. When the General Assembly met in the little church beside the river, it marked the first step in the building of this country's democratic institutions. Antedating the Mayflower Compact by more than a year, this was a year before the Mayflower landed, this first Virginia General Assembly was a milestone in the history of liberal government. This was a quote from A History of Virginia by a guy called Dabney. Now Virginia had a legislative, administrative, and judicial system much more closely in accord with that prevailing in England. But it was elected under a franchise more liberal than what you had in England. So more people were able to vote than were able to vote in England, is what it was saying. Everything was based on the biblical principles they had learned since the Bible became available in English in 1537. The laws were based on the Ten Commandments, which still hang in the church of the Jamestown settlement. It was interesting, when our guide was walking us around, he asked, what's the difference between the King James translation of the Bible and the Catholic Bible? And the first thing I could think of was, I said, well, the second commandment is different. And he said, well, you know, he didn't know that. He said, oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting. So that was, but then he said, no, that wasn't what I was asking. He said, what's the main difference? And I wasn't sure what he was getting at, but then I said, well, the Catholic Bible was in Latin. But the Catholic Bible was not available, you see, to anybody. So that's what took me back a little bit with the question. But the English Bible, the King James Bible, was in English. And that was the answer he had been looking for, because by this time everybody else had wandered off, and it was just him and me, basically. So he wasn't going to get into a deep theological discussion here. But the Ten Commandments were hanging on the wall in the church, still preserved from 400 years ago. Again, reading from Bobrick's book, by royal injunction, the Lord's Prayer and the Ten Commandments in English were to be taught sentence by sentence on Sundays and holy days throughout the year. At least one sermon on the gospel was to be preached every quarter. And every parish church was to set up in some convenient place a copy of the English Bible accessible to all as the very lively word of God. Now, Bruton Parish Church has gone against this, because this was the decree in 1537 that the Bible must be placed in a convenient place for everybody to read it, not in the bell tower locked in a case where nobody can read it. Okay? So you see this, the change that has taken place here. Throughout the kingdom, copies for public use and edification were soon chained to lecterns in the vestibules of churches, six of them in St. Paul's Church alone. So everybody could read the Bible. Anybody could go in and read it at any time. But not anymore, not in Bruton Parish Church. You know, I wanted to go. They had a Barnes & Noble just outside of Colonial Williamsburg. And the architecture was interesting. They had obviously trying to preserve the kind of atmosphere. And I wanted to go in there just to see if they had a Bible, but we didn't have time, unfortunately. But it would have been interesting, because if they hadn't got one, then, you know, that would say it all, I think, sum everything up. Look at another scripture in Genesis chapter 12 for a moment. Because here is God promising that Abraham's descendants would be a blessing. And I don't think we've ever really focused on this before, but I think it's a very significant point that we ought to mentioned in our literature regarding the United States and Britain. Now, the Lord had said to Abraham, get out of your country, from your family, and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. And you shall be a blessing. So you will be a blessing to other nations. I will bless those who bless you. And I will curse him who curses you. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Now, the last point there, in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed, spiritually applies to Abraham's descendant, Jesus Christ, who paid the penalty for our sins, without which we cannot receive eternal life. But if you look it up in commentaries, it will tell you that there's also a physical element here, that physical blessings would come to Abraham's descendant, Israel. And, of course, a great deal of wealth has been created by the Israelites, the modern Israelites, in the last 250 years. But I think there's also another blessing here, and that is the Bible itself. Because the Bible was taken by the English-speaking nations to the world. And because English today is spoken so widely throughout the world, the Bible has become accessible to hundreds of millions of people. And all of the countries that England ruled, I mean, all the different colonies around the world, all had, and most of them still have, freedom of religion. So people have the Bible. The reason why we have a church in Ghana is because it was a British colony. They've got the Bible. You go next door to the French countries, they don't have the Bible. The French never had that freedom. So they don't have the Bible. You can't find a Bible in the French countries. They're Catholic countries, and the Bible is not something which is sold. But it's available in the English-speaking countries. And again, it just reminds us of how important the Bible is. But go back to Deuteronomy chapter 28 again. Because we need to understand this, the importance of this, and pass it on to our children as well. Because here in Deuteronomy 28, in one chapter, we really see the history of modern Israel, the United States and Britain. In one chapter here. It says in verse 1, it shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments, which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth. That's exactly what happened. The rise to preeminence really began in Jamestown, because that was the first English colony. And gradually, of course, England had colonies all over the place, all over the world. But it was a direct challenge to Spain, which had been given the world by the Pope. And, you know, England could have just sat back and let the Pope do his thing, and all these other countries would have spoken Spanish, and we would never have existed as a nation. But England defied that, and this colony was established, named after Virginia, named Virginia after the Virgin Queen, Elizabeth I, who was the one who defied Rome. So there was a symbolism there as well. And notice that their rise to preeminence, because they were Israelites, this applies to Israel. It doesn't apply to Gentile nations because, you know, Gentile nations achieve their preeminence basically through violence and conquest and skullduggery and everything else. But, you know, the Israelites would be given preeminence if they obeyed the voice of the Lord their God. And you look at all the laws back then. They were all based on the Bible. As I've said before, the one glaring difference is that they kept Sunday and not the Sabbath. But they were very strict about Sunday. I mean, how much more strict can you get than if you don't go to church, you don't eat? And the second time you don't go to church, you'll be put in the stocks. The third time you don't go to church, you're put to death. I mean, that is pretty strict, I would say, when it comes to Sabbath observance. And that's the way it was for a long period of time, not just in Jamestown, but in other settlements too. And then it continues, all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you, because you obey the voice of the Lord your God. Blessed shall you be in the city, blessed shall you be in the country, blessed shall be the fruit of your body, the produce of your ground, the increase of your herds, the increase of your cattle, and the offspring of your flocks. All this prosperity would come upon them as a result of their obedience to God. And that is exactly what followed. Virginia became a very prosperous colony. And, you know, gradually, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people moved there, and not just to Virginia, but the other colonies as well. because of the prosperity that they were able to create there. Now, Virginia had not been prosperous before. You know, when the Native Americans were there, they hunted and fished. But it wasn't prosperous, not in the sense that Virginia became in the later 1600s and the 1700s. Blessed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Blessed shall you be when you come in. Blessed shall you be when you go out. In other words, you'll live in peace and security. The Lord will cause your enemies who rise against you to be defeated before your face. They shall come out against you one way and flee before you seven ways. Which is exactly what happened with the native population. The native population was hostile to the English settlers almost immediately. In fact, it was immediately. Kieran Doherty brings that out in his book. From the very first day, there was friction because it was a clash of two different cultures. But gradually, the English settlers achieved the preeminence, not just in Virginia, but throughout the whole of North America, except for Mexico. The Lord will command the blessing on you in your storehouses and in all to which you set your hand. He will bless you in the land which the Lord your God is giving you. The Lord will establish you as a holy people to himself, just as he has sworn to you if you keep the commandments of the Lord your God and walk in his ways. Then all peoples of the earth shall see that you are called by the name of the Lord, and they shall be afraid of you. And, this was achieved for a long period of time. Other nations were afraid of Britain in particular, the United States later on in the 20th century. And the Lord will grant you plenty of goods in the fruit of your body and the increase of your livestock and in the produce of your ground and the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers to give you. The Lord will open to you his good treasure, the heavens, to give the rain to your land in its season and to bless all the work of your hand. You shall lend to many nations, but you shall not borrow. It's exactly the way it was for a long period of time. And the Lord will make you the head and not the tail. In other words, you will be in control. The Israelites will be in control. They'll be the head and not the tail. You shall be above only and not be beneath. You'll be ruling over others. They won't be ruling over you. If you heed the commandments of the Lord your God, which I command you today, and are careful to observe them, so you shall not turn aside from any of the words which I command you this day, to the right or the left, to go after other gods to serve them. So the Israelites just had to obey God's laws, not deviate. Obey God's laws to the best of their understanding. They may not have understood everything, but, our nations were based on the laws of God right up until the 1960s. So we come to the 1960s in verse 15. It shall come to pass, if you do not obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments and his statutes, which I command you today, that all these curses will come upon you and overtake you. Cursed shall you be in the city, cursed shall you be in the country, cursed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl, cursed shall be the fruit of your body and the produce of your land, the increase of your cattle and the offspring of your flocks. Cursed shall you be when you come in, cursed shall you be when you go out. And it begins all these cursings, the punishments that come as the Israelites turn away from God. And that is, again, exactly what we are seeing happening at this present time. Let's look at a couple of other scriptures here. We could read more of the cursings, but it gets rather negative and depressing. But I think it's good to read it and be aware of it, because you read these things in the newspapers. You see them on TV. This is what is happening progressively, gradually, not all at once, but progressively. This is what is coming upon us. And it is because of the rejection of God's laws and not obeying God anymore. Look at Genesis 49. Beginning in verse 22, because here is a prophecy relating to Joseph at the end time, which is both Ephraim and Manasseh, the U.S. and Britain. Joseph is a fruitful bough by a well. His branches run over the wall. Okay, a fruitful bough. Great prosperity just spreading out as a result of investment around the wall, for example. The archers have bitterly grieved him, shot at him, and hated him. So here's a prophecy regarding wars, attacks from foreign nations. And we've had, a lot of wars in our history. But his bow remained in strength, it says, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. So, God has enabled us to win those wars in the past, is what it's saying here. But notice the book of Hosea, because, you know, we're not doing so well anymore in fighting wars. And the book of Hosea, I think, helps us to understand why. Hosea chapter 7. Hosea is a prophecy, again, relating to Israel. And in Hosea 7 and verse 15, similar terminology is used to what we just saw in Genesis 49. In Genesis 49, it says, his bow remained in strength, and the arms of his hands were made strong by the hands of the mighty God of Jacob. In Hosea 7 and verse 15, it says, though I disciplined and strengthened their arms, yet they devise evil against me. So although God disciplined and strengthened their arms, you know, helping them win these conflicts, they devise evil against me. They're constantly changing the laws, which turn the people more and more against me, is what God is saying. Which is exactly, of course, you know, what has been happening. So what will be the end result of all this? Well, Hosea chapter 4, verses 6 and 7 help us to see it. In verses 6 and 7 of Hosea 4, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. You know, that is so true today. My wife and I recently checked out a movie called The Painted Veil. It's a classic novel by W. Somerset Maugham, who was an English novelist in the 1920s. He lived in the Far East when Britain ruled lots of countries out there. And a lot of his novels are set in some of those countries, and some of them are quite interesting. And The Painted Veil is about a doctor whose wife commits adultery, and the marriage then obviously on the rocks, but it's how through a cholera epidemic they all come together. But anyway, when the first movie was made 50 years ago by Hollywood, the title was The Seventh Sin. Back then, in 1957, all Americans knew what The Seventh Sin was. You couldn't call it that today, so today it's called The Painted Veil, back to the original title of the book, because who would know what The Seventh Sin is? Nobody. And of course, you know, you've got almost as many Catholics as Protestants, and the Catholic Bible doesn't list you shall not commit adultery as the seventh sin anyway. So, you see, there's no way you could call it that today. So, you know, they've changed the title. My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge of God and an understanding of God's laws. Because you have rejected knowledge, I also will reject you from being priests for me. He's speaking specifically to the priests, but you know, the principle applies to the country too. Because you have forgotten the law of your God, I also will forget your children. The more they increased, the more they sinned against me. The richer they became, the more they increased, the more they sinned against me. The richer they became, the more they turned against God. In verse 8, they eat up the sins of my people. You know, a reference to all the scandal magazines and the news programs that all revolve around scandal that people are always watching. Look at chapter 5 of Hosea as well, because, you know, there's an interesting terminology used here. Now, Hosea 5 deals with the fall of Israel, which is still in the future. But it's interesting, just one sentence I want you to note. Verse 5, the pride of Israel testifies to his face. Therefore, Israel and Ephraim stumble in their iniquity. Judah also stumbles with them. With their flocks and herds, they shall go to seek the Lord, but they will not find him. He has withdrawn himself from them. They've dealt treacherously with the Lord, for they have begotten pagan children. Pagan children. Children not versed in God's ways. Not educated in the scriptures. Totally clueless as to what God expects of them. Like it said in chapter 4, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. And they now have pagan children who have no understanding of God. And, you know, that's a condemnation of the parents. You go back to Deuteronomy chapter 6, and it makes it clear that parents have a responsibility to teach their children about God. But, you know, there's, I think far less parents would do that today than, you know, encourage their children in other ways. Deuteronomy chapter 6, in verse 6, these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. So, you know, the responsibility of parents was to educate their children the laws of God. So again, to look at Deuteronomy chapter 28, the important point that comes out in Deuteronomy chapter 28 is that when an Israelite nation blesses God or obeys God, then it will prosper and everybody will live well forever. But when it turns away from God, then it's going to have problems. And it's even going to be defeated in wars, as we saw in the book of Hosea. And this is the story of the United States, just in this one chapter, Deuteronomy chapter 28. The Bible was the most important book. In fact, copies of the Bible were the only books that were brought on that, on those ships that settled in Jamestown. It wasn't the King James initially, because the King James didn't come out till 1611. People didn't bring any other books. You know, what other books did you need? Later on, people would bring books on things like, you know, animal husbandry and things like that. But initially, they had to keep the weight down on the ship. And the only books that people were able to bring were the Bible. And, you know, that was there was an incredible enthusiasm for the Bible. And historians say this did not cease until the 1900s. That's when the English-speaking people started turning away from the Bible. And that's the great change that took place. So, one thing I think we can learn from all this, we can pass this on to our children, help them to understand the importance of the Bible in American history, help them also to understand, to appreciate the Bible, to realize that, you know, these people risked their lives in order to give us the Bible. Look at Acts chapter 17. There's a couple of other scriptures here to look at. But Acts chapter 17, you know, I think sometimes we don't appreciate the Bible as much as we should. And, you know, these people brought their Bibles with them. They chose Jamestown, which is a miserable place to live, because that way they could hide from the Spanish who would have burned all their Bibles. So, you know, they would never have been allowed to have them, and they would have been forced to recant and become Catholics. So, you know, they had this incredible dedication and the zeal for the Bible. And you see that here in Acts chapter 17, an account of the Bereans who, you know, were very dedicated to the Bible. It says in verse 10, the brethren immediately sent Paul and Silas away by night to Berea. When they arrived, they went into the synagogue of the Jews. These were more fair-minded than those in Thessalonica, in that they received the word with all readiness and searched the scriptures daily to find out whether these things were so. You know, they studied the Bible daily, and therefore many of them believed. You know, when you study the Bible daily, then you're going to come to a better understanding of things than most people will have. And, you know, that's something that we can learn from these people and appreciate, just the need to really study the Bible and appreciate it and to value it as much as they did. Go back to Deuteronomy chapter 28 again, the blessings and cursings chapter, because it does get very disturbing on the way down. You know, it's interesting even to see what is happening today, because, you know, you look, for example, at Jamestown. This is something that you reflect on when you're in a place like Jamestown. 104 settlers arrived. By the end of a few months, it was down to 38. And yet those people, who would have thought, standing there at that time, who would have thought that those people would eventually take over the whole of North America apart from Mexico? Those people, their descendants, and some more that came after them. Do you think the Native Americans were looking at those 38 thinking they're going to take, you know, take all our land, take us over, we'll all die? Of course not. You know, there were only 38 of them after a few months. What kind of a threat were they? Okay? And yet eventually they took over the whole of North America. Now we see the reverse happening. You know, every time I get on a plane coming from Ghana, it is full of people coming from Ghana to live in the United States. And there's dozens of planes every day coming from third world countries to the United States, bringing far more people than were ever brought on those ships to Jamestown. Could those people take over the United States at some time? Well, of course they could. In fact, that's exactly what Deuteronomy 28 says is going to happen. It says in verse 32 and verse 33, Your sons and your daughters shall be given to another people, and your eyes shall look and fail with longing for them all day long, and there shall be no strength in your hand. A nation whom you have not known shall eat the fruit of your land and the produce of your labor, and you shall be only oppressed and crushed continually, because eventually they'll end up in charge. Just as the Native Americans eventually realized, you know, these white settlers were going to take over and be in charge. So these other people will in turn be in charge of the Israelites, because the Israelites have turned away from God. In verse 43, the alien who is among you, the alien, the Gentile, the stranger who is among you, shall rise higher and higher above you, and you shall come down lower and lower. He shall lend to you, but you shall not lend to him. He shall be the head, and you shall be the tail. See, the reverse of what was prophesied. The Israelites were told they would be the head. But now, the Israelites will be the tail. You know, because these other people are going to come and take over, basically. And, you know, it's very significant that these things are happening. And we see that happening today. So, you know, Deuteronomy 28 really is the history of the United States in one chapter of the Bible. And you see it so clearly when you look at it. And you can see it also quite clearly by looking at a place like Jamestown. I find Jamestown rather interesting on this particular trip because the emphasis had changed. When I was there 4 years ago, the emphasis was on how Jamestown was the first English settlement, the first democratic system, and it spread and became the United States. Now the emphasis is different. The emphasis is on bringing three cultures together. The English, the Native Americans, the African Americans who arrived in 1619. Those three cultures together created the United States. That is the implication. And then, of course, it also is saying, in effect, that all these cultures of the world, all the cultures in the world can come together and all be Americans. That's the basic message they're saying. But that is not what Deuteronomy 28 says. It says, you know, we're going to get all these people coming in and they're going to take over. And it's because the people, the Israelites, have turned away from God. And that has messed up people's thinking. And so you get all these other religions like Islam and so on coming in. So just an interesting thought, which you know, became clear visiting Jamestown and Williamsburg. And I thought I'd share that with you. So hopefully you can all stay around for a while and we'll get to talk.